Hello, everyone, and welcome back for another episode of the Endless Spiral podcast. I am, as always, your host, Keith Russell. This is the mental health show where I speak to anyone and everyone with a story to tell, as well as getting advice from experts in their chosen field. Now, on today's podcast, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by the multi-talented Megan Scully. Megan hosts a show on Classic Hits. She has written a book called Broken Love. She's contributed to the book series called Mental Health for Millennials. And she also hosts a show on Virgin Media Player called What's the Story? So she's super, super busy. So thanks very much, Megan, for coming on the show today. If I can get my thoughts in line, are you okay? How's everyone?
Good, yeah. And you hit the nail on the head there. The wet, wind, rain, cold. I mean, it's just, it's pretty miserable at the moment. But I guess, I don't know why every time this happens every year and every year we're surprised.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, I was trying to think of the intro and we were talking about the weather just beforehand and the weather's still in my head. I saw all over the shop of that. Anyway, look, I usually like to start off the podcast by kind of asking the guests kind of how they've been during the pandemic and during lockdown. Because obviously, as I said in the intro, you've got loads going on and you're super busy. And obviously, as I was saying to you before we started recording, I turned into a borderline recluse with the pandemic. So like, how's it affected you?
I have to say, I think pre-pandemic, I was probably working 6, sometimes 7 days a week. And I was up in Dublin every single weekend recording my show on Classic Hits and was working in Limerick and Cork and Galway. And I was just kind of here, there and everywhere. And I remember at the time thinking, I absolutely like love this. I love the adrenaline. And I also play a lot of tag rugby. And then I also socialize as well. So I was going out and I was here, there and everywhere. And there's a lot of events happening and everything. And I was just kind of turning up to everything. And then I remember people saying to me, they're like, I actually get tired looking at your stories on social media. They're like, I don't know how you keep doing it. And I was like, well, I actually love it. And then I guess people had said to me as well, they're like, you should be careful of burnout. And I was like, no, I understand that. And I, you know, I'm aware of that as well. But at the time I remember thinking, no, I can't slow down because everything's at my cusp now and my career is growing and growing. And I just thought, I can't say no to anything right now. I need to just stay going. And, you know, some opportunity is going to come my way and I can't miss it. And I guess that was kind of my mindset behind it. And then obviously, as we all know, when March 2020 came around, like everyone else, I had to be, like everything just stopped and I was suddenly working from home. And then work then started to kind of be taken off me. I used to do a lot of MC work and hosting, and I used to give talks and everything, and then that all went. And then suddenly I couldn't go up to Dublin anymore for the radio show, so I was taken off air initially. And then my main job with the Limerick Post was put down to 3-day week because obviously the work wasn't there. So that just seemed to be happening across the board. So I kind of went from working 6-7 days a week to suddenly having 3 days a week and sitting at home all the time. And initially I was like, oh, this isn't, you know, what am I going to do? This isn't good. And my career was just on the up and up and I was kind of like, you know, taking all these opportunities and now everything's just completely gone from my grasp. And luckily the Today Show in the RT Today Show that is based in Cork was continuing to go to air. And I got onto them and I just said, look, I have my own car so I can drive myself down if you ever need me. And thankfully they did. And I think they had me on pretty much every week that time. And it was great because I was able to get out of my 2K and I had my letters and I'd get stopped by the guards on the way down to Cork. And I was like, I have my letters. And I was so excited. So for me, I felt lucky in that sense because I got to get out of my county as well. And I got to travel and go and be on TV. And then I realized there was kind of a silver lining to it because everyone was sitting at home. So more and more people are watching television because people weren't going anywhere. So in that sense, I was like, okay, maybe this is good because more eyes were getting to see the work that I do. But I guess I had to suddenly reevaluate and kind of think, right, what am I going to do with my time? And I think maybe being in the creative world, it's like we never really stop. It's like we can't just do nothing. So I started vlogging initially because I was like, right, I want to get better at video editing. And I was like, I'm just going to vlog my lockdown life. Now, not really much happening because we're in lockdown. So I kind of just shared my day-to-day life every few days. But again, it was more so I could get my video editing skills up better and faster. And to be honest, it was actually brilliant because that's exactly what it did. And then my Limerick Post show, which used to be in person, moved online. So that was on Zoom. So it meant then I could churn out videos and interviews quicker because of my vlog. So I guess I had that going. And then I just realized then that my head was still a bit like, oh my God, you're completely on your own now. you need to really, you, and I was like, right, that's it. I'm using this time wisely. I did a well-being course with Yale University that was online and I loved it. And it was a course on happiness. And it was actually, it was some stuff I already knew, but then it kind of solidified maybe what I already knew and just kind of helped me to, I guess, see and appreciate maybe the simple things in life. I started reading a lot more, and then meditation. I kind of was dabbling in meditation for a while, but then during lockdown, I made it a daily part of my routine and home workouts like everyone else. I was like, I even looking at this carpet below me, I'm like, if I have to do one more burpee on that carpet, I actually can't, because I did so many burpees on that carpet during lockdown that I think I've got like a bit of a fear of them now built up. But yeah, so I said I did use the time wisely, but that's probably because I'd already experienced loneliness prior to lockdown that I think maybe prepared me for that time. So I maybe didn't find it as difficult as other people, because I think a lot of people were thrown into that loneliness without maybe being ready for it. And, you know, it really was a time that you had to, I guess, listen to the noise in your head and think, what do I really like and what do I really want? And I really feel like I made the most of my lockdown. And I really feel I used it to grow personally, professionally, mentally, and physically. So I think in that sense, I just was like, right, you just have to do this. You have to get through it. And like, it was definitely, there was definitely days that I found really, really tough and really lonely. But then I was like, right, why do I feel lonely today? Okay, let's feel what's that feeling that I have? Why do I feel like this? Okay, I'm going to meditate on it and see what comes out. Okay, I'm going to try write and see what happens. And that's what I did. So I'm very much so, I think when I feel a certain mood, I love to explore it and see what's going on and why. And then I try to see what's causing it. And that's what I did. I guess a lot of personal growth in that time.
Jesus Christ. You are super busy. I talk about being like, I thought I was productive during the lockdown. Jesus Christ. But you know what? Just as you're like, because I was going to ask you, like, what do you like? Like, you know, say things are quiet and you have time to yourself and you have time to your thoughts. And I know for me, maybe more in the past and so now, and you start, your thoughts can be harmful as well. I'm trying to think of a better way of putting it, but they can be negative thoughts as well. But the fact, like you said, that if you, like, you know, you seem to be quite self-aware of your emotions and your feelings. And as you said, if you kind of feel something, you'll explore it. Like, that's amazing. But have you always been like that?
Oh, no, absolutely not. That's only, I'd say, something that I learned in my early 20s when I kind of had no choice, because I've definitely had a journey already with my life, with loss and with, I suppose, my like parents' breakup when I was a child, and breakups and just losing friendships, job rejections, like so many different things. And I found like when I sometimes I reflect, I think my early 20s were probably a really dark time and a really dark place. And it pushed me to have to explore these things and to figure out what I want and where I was going. And I was living in London then back in 2013, 2014. And that's what I really experienced. I sometimes think like that was kind of in ways my lockdown. I was over there working I was doing an internship. And while Monday to Friday was just chock-a-block in work, because it was a very much so work hard, play hard from Monday to Friday. But weekends, what I found over in the UK, and I've spoken to a few people about this and they agree, the English people are very good for like doing stuff the weekends, but they get out of the city, they go to the countryside, and that's what they do. But they plan like weeks ahead. So I found up like that time I was very spontaneous, and I'm like, oh, it's Friday. What's everyone doing tonight? Where's everyone going? Well, they're like, oh, I just have to catch the train because I'm out to the countryside and I'm going here and I'm going there. And I was like, oh, I thought we might do a night out or something. And it's just like, yeah, I'm free in about 6 weeks. And it's like, oh, okay. And then I've realized then a weekend that, yeah, no, it was crazy. Like people really planned ahead. And then I realized then that, right, from Friday evening till Monday morning, I was pretty much on my own over there. Right. And while I had the, you know, a few Irish friends to meet up with and stuff, I just realized that I felt like I was completely on my own. So I think for me, that was kind of my lockdown. And that's when I had to learn some probably very hard lessons.
And obviously, like you mentioned, your journey there, and we'll get to that as well, because kind of one of the topics of this particular episode is grief as well. So like, we'll get to all that as well. We'll do it now, actually, because it kind of leads me on nicely anyway, because I was going to ask you about your writing. And because I had Dara Fleming on the last episode, and he was talking about how, you know, he kind of bottled up his emotions for a long time. And I know I read an interview that you kind of said something similar. And then he found that obviously writing was able to help him deal with like a lot of emotions, and it was mindfulness to him. And I was going to ask you about that as well, but before that, maybe we'll go back then and we'll start at the beginning, because you've obviously been quite outspoken about kind of grief and stuff, and yeah, and dealing with that and dealing with your emotions. So will we kind of, because you mentioned just a few minutes ago about your teens, or especially your 20s, was not, you know, a kind of a dark place for you. And I was similar, not from grief, but I always say like my teens and my 20s were pretty much a write-off. I nearly don't even want to acknowledge that time was. But like, how was it for you? So you had some grief, and you know, you unfortunately lost your brother, and then your dad about, was it 18 months after that? And then you had to deal with all of that. Like, it must have been so, so difficult.
Yeah, so I guess it was, I remember, would say, I'll go to maybe 2004 first, and I was in secondary school, and at this stage, I had gone to three national schools, because I was born in Dublin, and I went to St. Tractas in, just in near Dundrum, and I went there first. I started there, and then, as I mentioned, my parents had separated, and then we moved to on Spitzel and Connemara to the Gaeltacht, my mum, brother, and I, and we were 5 years there renting houses and living by the beach. And mum and I look back at that time and just think, oh my God, that was just like the dream. We were living by a beach and we swam all the time and we were in the water all the time. And I guess that's where my love for Irish came about, because we were in the Gaeltacht. So we were not only blow-ins to Spittle, but we were English-speaking blow-ins. And I guess being children and being in the school system, we learned pretty fast and we started speaking Irish, and for sure no time we were fluent. And then we moved to Ardrahan, which is in South Galway, where Mam is originally from. And we built a house next door to Granny on the farm. And then when I moved to Ardrahan, that was around 99-2000, and I went into my third national school. So that was an experience. I went from this huge, I suppose, suburban Dublin school to a really small Irish speaking school in the Gaeltacht, that was all girls, to a mixed country kind of GA school. That was a tiny school. So it was very much so different, and I was always guessed the new girl and stuff. So then I moved on to Seamount in Canberra, which was an all girls convent. So I went there for 3 years. So I remember coming up, I said 2004, and I remember then thinking, one day I remember thinking, oh, things actually kind of seem settled now. Like, we built a house, so we had finally maybe settled into a home. And Marcus was in boarding school in Garbley and Ballinasloe, and he was doing really well. Like, I mean, like all A's and B's, really sporty, you know, one of the best players in the sports teams, but also one of the top achievers in the class. So he kind of was a real all-rounder and really popular guy. And then my dad, in the meantime, after separation, my dad stayed in around Kildare, because he was big into horses, and he was, you know, living around the horse up there and had horses. So that's kind of where his life was seen to be set up. But he actually had ended up coming back to Galway as well, and moved to Crothwell, which is a couple of miles away from our home house. And he's actually originally from South Galway as well. So then, like, he had a house there. We had a house. He lived a couple of miles away. And suddenly the family unit was kind of back together, but it was probably at the healthiest it ever was, because my parents had overcome, I guess, all the breakup and the pain. And now suddenly they were actually friends and they got on quite well. And dad would spend a lot of time with me, because mum went back to college as a mature student, because I suppose she came out of school and worked for like a year or two maybe, and then like met dad, I think at 19, and was married at 21. So she never got to go to college, and that's one thing she wanted to do after the marriage broke down. So she went back as a mature student to NUI Galway. So while she'd be studying for exams and stuff, dad would move in with me. And so it was just a really kind of nice dynamic. And then I remember one day thinking, oh my God, everything actually seems kind of really settled for once and feels really normal. And I suppose at the time I was like 14 going on 15. And also Marcus and I had developed a really strong bond. After dad left, he definitely took over the father figure role and was quite strict with me. But I guess when he was in secondary school and I was in national school, there is that quite big divide between, you know, I don't know, I think whatever it is, we were only 2.5 years between us. When one's in secondary and one's in national, it seems like worlds apart. Yeah. But once I went to secondary school, our dynamic changed, and suddenly he wasn't the big, strict older brother. We became more friends, because I guess he probably realized that that new age of stepping into being a teenager. So we got really close, and we very much so became really great friends as well. So it just seemed like everything was going really well, and I was doing well at school and doing well in sport, and dad and I had the horses together, so we'd go out horse riding at the weekend. So everything was just really coming together. And I sometimes I look back and think I seem to see that feel that and say that about everything being normal. And then that's when tragedy struck. So I often kind of reflect on that moment to kind of think, should I not have said that? Should I not have thought that? Should I not have felt that? But
I got that impression from when you were talking.
Yeah.
I could actually feel that from you, that as you were explaining that, you were nearly feeling guilty for just saying that.
Yeah, and I did. And for a long time, I think I did feel the guilt, kind of wondering maybe if I didn't say that, maybe if I didn't think that, maybe if I didn't feel that. But unfortunately, what we all learn in life is this: you can't control what happens and things happen and you just have to learn to accept it. But it was actually a Friday, 4th of March. And so we're close to that date now. And Marcus was at rugby training in Gort, which is, again, a couple of miles from the house. And I was actually at horse riding, and horse riding was between Gort and Ardrahan, there in a hill. And Dad died at horse riding. Mam was at home ironing Marcus's shirt because he was going out that night because he was 18 and he just finished his Leaving Cert mocks. I just finished my junior cert mocks. So that weekend for us was kind of a big weekend because he was getting to go out in town. And when I say town, we mean Galway City. We've always called it town. I don't know why, but it's just when I say town, that's what I mean. Same, so he's going out in town. Yeah, that's just, and even though Gort is a town, but we call Galway town. Yeah. And then I was going to my friend's house for the weekend, and we were all going hanging out in like one of the villages all together because we'd all finished our mocks. So it was kind of like exciting time. But that night then tragedy struck, and Marcus was involved in a car accident coming home from training. And I do remember that night, like it was definitely wasn't cold, wasn't icy, wasn't wintry. Like, in fact, it was quite a nice night because I said I was up on the horse. I was outside on the horse, and I remember weather definitely wasn't an issue. I think it was maybe just inexperience and speed. And Marcus was a passenger in the car, and we got a call, and we went to hospital that night. And unfortunately, and sadly and tragically, the driver, who was also our neighbour and Marcus's friend, and I'm friends with their siblings. Like, they literally live down the road from us. I grew up with them. They were our first friends actually in Ardrahan that we ever got to know. He lost his life instantly, but Marcus didn't. And Marcus was in hospital for a couple of hours, and you know, as the hours went on in A&E just filled up with all his friends and family, and more people started arriving in as the clock ticked. And I remember thinking, wow, this is amazing. Like, why are all these people are coming in? And I just think I never really understood maybe how bad it was. Mam said she knew as soon as the accident happened. She had this gut feeling. Nobody even told her there was an accident, but she said she feels like she knew instantly. And I think from what I've kind of learned through my own journey is that mothers have that connection and that intuition that I think with their children, that probably, like, I'm not a mother, so I don't know what that's like, but I think mothers know what it is. And that's, I guess, what happened. Mom, and I think Dad knew as well straight away because he'd been in and out of hospital. Like, he'd been ill for his mom. Dad was always sick. I just remember that. And I, of course, didn't think it at all. But there at around 1:30 in the morning, we got called in, and it was the 5th of March at this stage. And we got told that he hadn't survived. His injuries were, I guess, there was nothing they could do. And they did try, and they were hours working on him. And that was it then. And I suppose that's kind of that day then, our lives completely changed forever. And it was just the most surreal moment. And I can remember that night so well, and I remember so many little details. And I can just remember being in that hospital, and the doctor coming out, and the nurse and family being there. And, you know, just straight away everyone just started crying and screaming and falling and grabbing me and holding me. And I was like, I remember just standing there in kind of absolute shock, thinking this wasn't happening, because I was a 15-year-old girl. I was meant to be going out with my friends that weekend. He was meant to be going out with his friends that weekend. This couldn't be happening. Like, he was planning to be a vet. He was, you know, studying really hard. He wanted to go to Dublin, but if he didn't get Dublin, he'd actually apply to Budapest. So he was very much so set on his way. Like, Marcus had drawn out the plans that he wanted for his house when he could build his own house. He had a girlfriend at the time as well. You know, he wanted children. And Marcus knew, he very much so knew what he wanted from life from quite a young age. And you know, it's just, that's where I think maybe it was so hard, because it was like, hold on a second, how does this guy go from having all these plans to suddenly having nothing? And how, you know, how could this be happening to us? And it just was, I guess, complete and utter shock, not for like us as a family, the whole community of South Galway, Spiddle, Dublin. Like, we'd connections all over because of all our moving, and, you know, we'd so many great people that, you know, hugely were affected by Marcus's death. So I guess that was just kind of the start of my journey, as they say.
Wow. I mean, to deal with something like that, I mean, I've never had to deal with it, but to deal with something like that at 15, like, how do you even process that? You know what I mean? Like, what goes through your head? I mean, it's just, you know, incredible.
Well, I think as you mentioned there, and as what Dara had said, I bottled it all because I probably spent a lot of my life always being the carer in some ways, because after my parents separated, I remember, like, mum was always so sad that time. I just remember us being in Dublin and mum pretty much crying all the time. And we did a little toilet under the stairs. And I can remember as far back as being like, because my parents, the breakdown probably started when I was about 2.5, 3. And I remember it, like, because obviously there was maybe heightened emotions in the house. And I'd pop under the stairs and grab tissue. And then when dad would like leave the house, I'd go into mum and hand her tissue because I knew she'd be upset. So I guess from then on, I kind of knew to look after her. And Marcus very much so stood up to that. I think Marcus was like 6 when dad left, and you know, he was the carer of mum and I at that age, and he was very protective of both of us and very strict with me, and he kind of called the shots from a young age. I think it was very much so what Marcus said was the way the house was run. And he kind of, I suppose, looked after mum and then looked after I. And then I said dad was always kind of sick, so I feel like I was always keeping an eye on him. You know, I'd spend a lot of time with him growing up, and we went to the horse show every year up in Dublin, and sometimes I could be there on my own with him for a few days and was constantly watching him. And I remember, like, I used to watch dad sleeping and to make sure he was still breathing, because I always had this fear that he'd die in his sleep, and I just always wanted to be with him, that if that was to happen, that he'd never die alone. But like, that's from when I was probably about 7, 8 years old onwards, because that's, I think, when the awareness was there that dad also had health issues. And it was such a big, I guess, something huge that I took on, but no one told me to take it on, but I think I felt like I had to. And then after Marcus died, you know, mum was just inconsolable. Like she just cried all the time. And, you know, I'd wake up in the middle of the night to hear her walking around the hallway, just wailing. And that was just kind of the way life was then. And dad then, on the other hand, was so angry and was so bitter and was just so resentful at everything, because his son was taken in one foul swoop, and, you know, life wasn't fair, and why did it do this to us? So both of them were two very different people. And unfortunately, their friendship struggled as well at the time, which is completely understandable. So I would be between the two houses trying to keep an eye on the two of them. And I just thought, like, there was never a space or a place for me to grieve, because I again thought that I had to care for them. So I thought, I can't show them my vulnerability, because if I show them what I'm truly feeling, who's going to mind them? And that's the way I looked at it, and that's when I decided I'm just not going to do that. So I often, mom remembers say to me, she's like, why do you never cry, you never cry? And I remember sometimes looking at her, and internally I was screaming, going, because you're always crying, I cannot cry because you were always crying. And I didn't want to cry in front of her because I didn't want her to think that she had to care for me. So as I said, I just bottled it, and like, I cry into my pillow definitely plenty of times. And that's, I guess, where the writing for me changed. I think I've always been a writer. I was always writing in my diary from a very young age about all the drama in school and this, what was going on and all the stories. But after that, then I guess my writing took on a new meaning, because that's when I could, that's the only place I felt I could actually express what was going on, because I couldn't really say it to anyone. Well, I felt I couldn't say it to anyone. Obviously, there was probably everyone out there was only waiting for me to come to them, but I just thought no. And as I just bottled it all up and I just stayed writing.
Yeah. Wow, Megan, Jesus, like, you're an incredible person, like, to be, you know, to basically put yourself to one side and look after your parents like that is just incredible. I'm actually kind of lost for words, because I just think that is, that's one of the bravest things I've ever heard anyone do. So that's just like absolutely incredible. Between your brother and you losing your dad, it was like 18 months. So in that 18 months, you were pretty much the kind of, I wouldn't say glue that was holding them together, but you weren't, if you know what I mean, you were supposed to be the carer, and you were just basically, like, you must have been worn out mentally and physically yourself.
I think maybe, I don't know, was it because I was 15? I don't know if it was Marcus giving me strength. I don't know if it was, I think school definitely played a huge part in that part of my life, because I had to go back and sit my junior cert. And I have to say, the teachers and my friends in my school were just phenomenal. Like, my friends were all 15 years of age, and to be fair, a lot of my best friends in school were mad about Marcus. They were great friends with him. We come from a pretty modest small house and nice to, I was reflecting on it recently. And I was like, everyone wanted to come to our house. And thinking back, I think it's just because everyone wanted to see Marcus, because, you know, he was really popular. He was really friendly to them all. Like, we'd have sleepovers and Marcus made time for everyone that came into the house. And all my friends were just so fond of him as well. And I think for them, you know, they lost Marcus too. And I suppose they felt they had to look after me in some way. So I guess they'd never really told me how much it affected them, but I know it did. But as I said, when I went into school, I could finally, it was in one place I could get relief from the grief and get away from my home house. And it's a place where I felt like I could be myself. And initially teachers were like, just sit here. You don't have to, like, you don't even have to open a book. You don't have to partake in the class. You don't even have to, you know, you just be here when you're ready. But I found then after a while, I was like, well, I kind of want to answer that. And suddenly I started taking part again, because the one thing that Marcus did for me was he was so studious that he was the boss at the weekend. So everything I did had to be what Marcus did. So if he studied, I had to study. If he had a cup of tea, I could have a cup of tea. If he watched TV, I could watch TV, but I couldn't watch TV if he was studying. So he, I guess, put in those foundations of, like, this is the way you should do things and routine. And because he was in boarding school, I think he had that really strong routine and he loved it there. And I guess that's what he's trying to instill in me. So I think after that, he died in March and the junior cert was in June. And I kind of wanted to do him proud because he had, I guess, kind of, he was setting me up for exams. So I was like, right, I'm just going to get the head down and do this for him. And to be honest, like, my junior cert was all A's, B's. And I was like, when I look back at it now, I'm like, I don't even know how I managed to pass those exams because things were so bad. But I think I used school as my distraction and I used studying to get away from things. And I think that's where I found it easier to bottle. And then I actually moved schools after that because I wanted to get out of the convent and I want to go to the mixed school. And initially, Marcus got on my side first. So once I had Marcus on my side, I knew I'd win Mam over, because Anthony Marcus said Mam was like, yeah, okay. Everything was like, he's very much so Mammy's boy. And like I said, he kind of called the shots sometimes. So she was like, okay, fine. We just need to convince your father. And I was like, oh God, this is going to be the worst. But we all together swayed Dad, even though Dad didn't live with us. And he like probably didn't know about half the stuff I was up to during the week because he wasn't there, but he still had very much so say in my education. And the deal was that I could move, but if by Christmas my grades had dropped at all, I'd go straight back to the girls' school. And I was like, okay, that's fine. But sure, in the meantime, then we had Marcus's accident. And then I suppose suddenly maybe my parents realized that my education probably wasn't as important as they maybe were making it to be. But for me, it was, because it was distraction. So when I moved to Gort Community School, which is, again, a couple of miles away, even though I knew quite a lot of people already because we're all from South Galway, I got to meet new people and kind of the new dynamic and being in a mixed school and a much bigger school and sport and definitely like extracurricular activities. So again, I think at that age, it was just everything for me was about distraction, about finding the next distraction, about getting kind of keeping out of my home house as much as I possibly could and trying to stay away from all that. And then obviously with Dad as well, he was just starting to get sicker and sicker. So then trying to spend time with him too. It definitely was, reflecting on it now, to be honest, I don't think I'd be able to juggle all that right now again. Like, I think at the time, I don't know what, as I said, I think it must have been Marcus that was helping me along the way, because sometimes I do wonder how I actually coped and managed it all.
Yeah. I read a couple of interviews and I wrote a few quotes down because it was kind of just something similar to what you said there. I'll just read them to you now. So in college, nobody knew about my grief. I didn't have to tell anyone about my brother and my dad. It was just what I needed. I was outgoing and chatty in college. I was alive and soul at a party and always organizing fun events for friends. I never showed anyone my vulnerable side. So that was kind of the same. So when you were kind of looking after your mom and dad, you were kind of the same there, really. You weren't showing your vulnerable side. And then when you went to college, you kind of had that mask on again. I mean, I suppose as you found out, there's only so long that you can kind of carry that mask around before it'll catch up with you anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's probably one of the greatest lessons I ever have learned through all this is that, as you said, it's going to catch up with you at some stage or another, and you can stay running and you can stay hiding and stay fighting it, but at some stage it's going to have to rear its ugly head and you're just going to have to face it head on. And I think sometimes for people that can be the scariest part and the most daunting thing ever, but like doing that is actually going to be the best thing ever, because you need, I really think, to kind of maybe live a fulfilling life and to get the most out of life, I really think you have to kind of, I guess, deal with the demons. I know that's what it was like for me. And I just think the grief, as I said, the grief is going to catch up with me at some stage. And college was so great. But I think the 4 years in University of Limerick were definitely really great fun and are probably the reason why I still live in Limerick now, or why I actually moved back to Limerick, because I had such a great time there, because I always feel like the grief was, it's always, I guess it was always there, but I felt like it kind of didn't really kind of interfere with my life too much. But then it was during my master's in Galway that it just was like, okay, you've had too much fun now. You've had too much running. I'm like going to explode here because you have ignored me for so long. And I remember thinking, I could feel it coming, and I knew it was coming, and I knew it was coming heavy. And I tried and tried and tried until I think I just had nowhere else to run, and I was like cornered, and I just had to face it head on. And I, at that stage, I was so, and I've used this quote now a few times, I was so depleted and deflated and defeated that I kind of had to surrender to it in some ways as well. And I just had to turn around and say, right, let's do this.
And did you just mentally and physically crash? Because you said you could feel it coming on for a while.
Yeah, so definitely it was towards the end of fourth year in UL that I felt a change in my mood. And I noticed that I was getting a little bit more erratic and a little bit ratty, whereas I was never like that before. I was always really happy-go-lucky, always up for the crack, and was just gone on with life, and that was it. And it was always, I said, life, it's all the party, and if there was a party, you can guarantee that I was in the middle of it. And that was just the way I was. I was always so sociable. I loved being around people and noise and crack and just everything like that. But then, as I said, towards the end of fourth year, I did start to notice something was different. And then I went on a J1, and that's just things. It was like I landed in a different country, and the Pandora's box or the bottle burst open, and everything felt like it was crumbling. And for the first time ever, I was really homesick. And I thought, this is really unusual, because I didn't think I'd be homesick, because in my head, I was getting away from all the grief. And yet when I got away from it, I suppose maybe, I don't know, was it that maybe I landed in America and thought, oh, I can breathe. And then suddenly it was like, well, hold on a second now, you just like loosened that cap, and yeah, we are going to explode. And then I just became really erratic. I fell out with everyone I lived with. I felt like every day there was a different drama, and I suddenly was caught in all of it. And I was like, why am I in all this drama? Like, this isn't like me. But then after a few weeks, I realized that I was the one who was causing all the drama, and I just felt I was ruining everyone else's J1. And I just thought, right, the best thing you can do now is just ring Aer Lingus there, see, can you get what's the next flight you can get out of here, pack your bags and go, and let everyone else at least enjoy the rest of their J1. And by this stage, I was actually vomiting every single day. So I was like, right, something's completely wrong here. Like, my stomach was just in ribbons. Every time I had food, every time I had a drink, anything, I just was projectile vomiting. And I was like, okay, what is going on here? And I thought maybe I'd develop some sort of stomach ulcer or sort of stomach issue. So I came home and like, I went on all these kind of diets to see if it was like, was it, maybe it's carbs, maybe it's gluten, you know, all these different things. And I tried all these diets and I was like, nothing's working. And I still was vomiting. And I was like, this has just gone way too much. And like, I think I went to the doctor as well, and they couldn't seem to figure it out, because I guess now what I've learned and what I did learn back then was that this was the actual grief that I was physically vomiting up from all those years of pushing it back down and ignoring it. And at this stage, the physical signs were now there. So it was, and also I lost, like, I think I'd lost, my friend said to me, she goes, the sparkle is gone from your eyes. So people could now physically see that I wasn't myself, and you could see the grief was just everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And was it just the writing that got you kind of through it, or did you try therapy, or was it just time, or was it a bit of everything maybe?
I think after Marcus died, Mam would have sent me straight into, like, I think like anyone she thought could help me. Like, Mam used to bring me into these people to talk. But to be honest, at the time, I remember I didn't want to talk, and I didn't really know how to verbalize the grief. And as I said, the writing was probably keeping me going in that sense, because it was the only place that I could make sense of things. And I do think, I guess it's like, you can bring the horse to the well, but you can't make it drink. And I think that was very true for me. And I think sometimes you have to want to go yourself as well. Now it is important, obviously, and it's great when people bring you, because when I was actually during that master's in Galway, and things absolutely fell apart, I lost relationship, I lost loads of friends, I stopped going into my lectures and everything. And my housemates at the time, they actually one day sat me down and were like, right, you're going to the college counselors because you need to. And I remember being like, what? No, I don't. And I went in and I did go for a few weeks. I remember thinking, like, I thought there was nothing wrong with me. I thought it was something wrong with everyone else around me. And genuinely at the time, I believed that. I was like, it's just them. It's like, it's their fault. It's not me. So while I went that time and while it was good, I still wasn't really aware, maybe, or maybe I didn't want to be aware that it was obviously all my own grief. And I actually didn't even realize it was grief at the time, because I remember reading a book somewhere and it said, oh, grief usually takes like 5 years until, and then after 5 years, you kind of learn to accept it. So I was like, this stage, I think I was on year six with Dad and year seven with Marcus. And I thought, well, I'm past it. Like, clearly I've bet grief, if, like, you know, in my head, that's what, yeah, I genuinely thought. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I've come out the other side. Like, and I was like, oh, I wonder how many people like skip grief the way I did. And I thought, geez, I was kind of proud of myself or something. I think I thought, like, I bet it. Like, and I don't know if that's, yeah, my competitive streak or what. And I think maybe, I don't know what it was. And then I actually went that time during that master's, I thought I'd lost my mind. And I thought I was like, I'm having a breakdown. And I thought then that I actually believed at the time that this was now going to be my life, that I was just not going to be happy anymore, and that I wasn't going to succeed in life, and that, you know, my dreams of being a TV and radio presenter were all but gone. I was like, sure, I couldn't be on camera because I physically just looked drained and sick. And then I was never going to be on radio because I was like, I'm not even happy enough to be on the radio to cheer people up and to entertain people. So I kind of then was like, right, that's it then. You just might as well. What's the point of even finishing this master's? What a waste of money. Like, what a waste. Like, what are you doing? Like, get out of here. And that's the internal battle I was having with myself. And I really thought that was it. And I was thinking then, I was like, right, I'll just move home now. And I'll, you know, maybe I'll just go on the dole and I'll just stay at home and not really leave the house. And honestly, at the time, that was my thought process. And I actually genuinely believed as well that I was never going to come out of it. I actually was like, right. I think sometimes when you're so rock bottom and you're in such a dark place, and like people say, oh, you know, you'll see the light or find the light or follow the light. And to be honest, I was like, there is no light. There's absolutely no light here. So I don't know why people are saying this to me. So, you know, that was definitely an internal battle I had for a very, very long time. You know, and I guess I got to the stage where I knew that it's not that counseling wasn't work. As I said to you, I was blaming everyone else. But it got to a stage then when things got so bad that I had to go to my GP because I knew myself I was kind of in a troublesome place, and I knew then that I needed help.
Yeah, well, fair play to you. Like, I mean, you acknowledged that you needed help and you got it eventually and you moved on. Well, I don't mean you moved on, but you were able to kind of get out of the rock bottom place, I suppose. So you wrote a book, Broken Love, and you also have contributed to Mental Health for Millennials. I think you've all the volumes, isn't there? Or so far, all of them. Yeah. So, and then obviously you said when you were younger, you used to, you know, write in your journal. And I suppose your journal was therapy for you, even though you might not have realized it at the time. So the point I'm asking is, was writing the book maybe therapy for you?
Yeah, and I actually think, so I suppose I continued writing all the time because, to be honest, I still couldn't rationalize the thoughts in my head, but the pen and paper was like, sometimes I didn't even know what I wanted to write and I would just put pen to paper. And I often say this to people, sometimes it's a really great place to start. And I'd literally just put the pen on the paper and I could sit there for a few minutes with nothing going on. And then suddenly it was like someone took over my hand. And then suddenly I'd start writing and writing and writing and writing. And then I'd have pages. And then I'm like, whoa, geez, I wrote a lot there. And then I'd go back and read over. And suddenly everything, it was like the thoughts then came out of my head and went on the paper. And I was like, oh, okay. And it just kind of helped maybe with the fog that was in there in some ways. And as well, then I eventually got to the stage where I knew I needed to talk to professionals, that I knew that I had the problem or that I had to figure out what was going on in my head. And that's when I started talking to therapists. And like, you know, I found as well, and I've said this a few times, and for me it was male therapists because I lost my brother and my father. I lost Marcus when I was 15, I lost Dad when I was 16, so I was able to connect and relate to a man much better because I guess in some ways I felt like I was speaking to my father, because my dad said when he died of an illness, and he that whole summer of 2006, he was kind of dying for that whole summer. And then he died on the 12th of August, and I was with him through all of that. So I watched him die and I watched him fade away, and I held his hand. And I remember, while my brother's death was so tragic and obviously completely unexpected, looking back on my diaries and writing Broken Love made me realize that my dad's death actually affected me more than my brother's death, which it sometimes makes no sense. And it was when I printed Broken Love that all my family, my aunties, my friends, people who I guess knew what I'd gone through, read the books and were like ringing me up and saying, oh my God, your dad's death completely affected you way more. And I think it's because Marcus, even though he was so young and it was so tragic, and he was 18 years and 18 days when we lost him, I look back in his life then, and it's like, even though he had all those plans for his future, he also tied up a lot of his life towards the last few days. And it's like subconsciously he kind of knew that he was coming to an end. Like, things he did in those last few days before he got killed were like, upon reflection, we were like, oh my God, he knew this was coming, because he spent time with all of us, and he had like these really important conversations with my mother, with my father, with me, with family, with friends. And it was just, now that we look back, we're like, oh my God, like, he was saying goodbye to us all, but we just didn't know. And I guess then I could realize after a while that Marcus was only meant to be here for 18 years and 18 days. And that, like, that moment was a huge realization for me. And then I felt like I could release him and I could let him go, because for years after Marcus and after Dad died, I couldn't let them go. I held on to them, and everything I did was for them. It was for Marcus. It was for Dad. And then I wasn't doing anything for me. And I remember speaking to a great friend, Heidi, and she said to me, she was like, it's your time now. And I remember thinking, I can't let go of them. I can't. And she was like, you know, and I remember that time then realizing, okay, I have to actually let them go. So I was able to let go of Marcus so much easier. Whereas when I came to Dad, I really struggled to let him go. And I guess it was from, as I said, the diary writing in the book that I realized how much that had an effect on my life and on my journey with grief. My parents separated when I was a toddler. And I said to you at the start, I remember that time so well. I remember the day he moved out. I remember the breakup. I remember the holidays, getting on trains and buses, heading up to Kildare, spending time with him, coming home and not seeing, obviously, him as much in my childhood, because he was the other side of the country and there wasn't motorways the way there is now. And I think as well, when he was dying, even though I knew he was dying, we never got to have those conversations that maybe we should have had. We never got to kind of, we never kind of got to, like, he didn't, there were things we probably should have both said to each other, things that I kind of wish I could have said to him. And there was kind of conversations I wish I could have had with him about so many different things in life, but I never got to have that, even though I was with him for all those months and weeks and days before he died. We never had that conversation. And I think that really was a huge effect on my life then in my 20s. And kind of then it probably affected my relationships with men after that as well. So it was just the book and then getting professional help really had that profound effect on my healing, I guess.
I suppose you just felt you never had closure with your father until maybe you wrote the book.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And yeah. You know, and as well in those counseling sessions with those, the male therapists, where suddenly I feel like I could connect with them because they were around the same age as my dad. And they kind of, I felt really safe when I was with them because I felt like I had a father figure sitting opposite me, and it just made it so much more. I suddenly was able to open up and I was suddenly able to actually unlock a lot of my grief. And in fact, a lot of grief from when my parents broke up, which I thought during my childhood I would have said never affected me, but obviously then in my 20s suddenly had a huge effect on my life.
Yeah. So how did the mental health for millennials come about? Because, like, as you said, you have a chapter in each volume. I think it's 5 volumes so far, or is it 4?
I've seen them from here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 is coming out in October.
That's what it is, right? Okay, because I remember Chris was telling me. Okay, right, so 6 is coming out. Yes, and you've a chapter in each one. So is it, which is, are each chapters are slightly a different part of your life, is it, or is it like kind of the same thing, but you know, as you grow, I suppose your story evolves, doesn't it? So It can be the same story but different as well.
Yeah, and I think every book has a different theme, so I kind of focus on the different theme each time. And I kind of find when it comes to my writing, when it comes to my interviews or podcasts or giving talks, I call in Marcus and Dad, or my granny, Dad's mother Olga. I call them in and I kind of just say, right, we're a team now, like, let's do this. So I don't really plan for what I'm going to write. I just kind of sit down. Again, with the creative thing, like, and it comes into my professional life as well. Some days I'm really productive and some days I am just like plan, like videos, content. And I'm just like, whoa, like everything's just coming at me and I have loads of energy and I'm just like putting up a load of stuff. And I think if you look at my following on Instagram, watch my stories, you can tell which days are my productive days, because suddenly like I'm just like, do, everything's going out. And then there's other days I'm just like, I just don't even want to leave the apartment today. Yeah. So I take those days when I feel like that, I do take that time seriously and take it off. So when it comes to my writing, some days I can literally write chapters and other days I can't write at all. So when I know that I'm in a mood to write, I will just go for it and see what happens. And I find sometimes then I read back over I sometimes write something, then I read back over it and I'm like, did I write that? Jeez, that's very powerful. And I think it's funny the way it comes out of my head.
Yourself, yeah.
And even when I wrote Broken Love, I remember going through all those old diaries and then they're obviously all handwritten. So I typed them all up and I was like, Jesus. And that was a huge moment for me too, because I read back over it and I'm like, God, that was very, kind of grown up, mature way of words for a 15-year-old girl. But then also I was obviously reading some really dark stuff. And I kind of, when I went through the dark stuff, I was like, oh my God, I was like, I cannot, now sometimes I read back over it, I'm like, I can't believe I was actually that low and that dark. And as I mentioned earlier, I was in that dark tunnel and I couldn't see any light and I thought I'd never get out of it. So sometimes now when I reflect back in that time, I just think, oh my God, breathe and just be like, you know, to realize that I came through that.
Yeah. And you're like, you've come a long way to be able to, you know, that to process things in that way, isn't it? So another thing I wanted to ask you about is your podcast, because you started your own podcast as well. And I definitely wanted to have a chat with you about that, because we were chatting about it the last day. So I wanted to ask you about it again, because I know you, like you said a second ago, and I think that's so important, is when you're having a down day, it's to just embrace it. And then when you're having a productive day, to embrace that as well. I actually think the two of them are very important, because when you don't embrace the down days, I used to find the down days will merge into your so-called productive days, because you're not having a break. So you need to have something as like a release. So if, say for me, if like this podcast could be my release or so, would that be with your podcast, or did you just kind of start the podcast as just, you know, another way of kind of processing things and that?
Yeah, and it's funny, the podcast was always an idea for a long time, and it was only at the end of 21 that I realized, right, you have to do this, like stop saying it, like stop talking about this podcast. And I actually made a mood board at the start of 21, and I had it up on my bathroom wall for ages, and I'd always read it and look at it, and I like personal and professional goals. And then one day I was like, right, stop looking at it now, you've read it enough, roll it up, put it away, get rid of it. And then I pulled it out there recently because just to have a look, and a podcast was on it, and a podcast was there, right there on the page, a podcast. So then I was like, oh my God, I forgot that I'd written that down. So I was like, oh, these things actually work. So I started the podcast and I said, I'll go down health and wellness first, because it's an area I guess I know and I'm familiar with. And I, during my journey, and even still, I tried every single, anything I thought would give me relief, like out of my pain or out of my suffering, I tried it. And, you know, Reiki and essential oils and, you know, meditation, yoga, you name it, like I tried them all. And I was like, you know, everything gave me some sort of relief and some sort of I guess, you know, helped me along the way. And then I kind of thought I'd like to chat to people who work in these fields to get their side of it, because while I can talk about it, it's great to hear from the professionals. And then I just kind of basically got on to people that I already know and met with people and just started recording it. And then what I found was, once I started getting into them, and I'm sure like you've had your podcast now for so much longer, and I actually really enjoyed this type of conversation, and it's made me realize how much I love talking to people and how much the art of conversation is so lovely. Whereas I think pre-lockdown, I was very much so music, and, you know, noise, you know, when in the car, it was always music, and now it's always podcasts. And I actually now realize how much I enjoy this. And I think, you know, podcasts are just great now, and I'm learning so much from them and learning so much about myself. And what started as a 6-episode podcast is now moving on because people are asking me now, you know, they're like, oh, I know someone that does this. Do you want to have them on? I'm like, yeah, let's go for it. So it's now become, I suppose it was a kind of a hobby, but it's something now that I'm just like, I would love to kind of in some ways not turn it into like a full-time job, but because I love it so much, I want it to become more part of my life because it's just so enjoyable.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And come on, we better give it a plug. What's the name of it? I know what it is.
It's called Megan Meets, and it's M-E-G-H-A-N-N Meets. So it's people I meet along the way. And I'm already thinking about like other series, what I could do and other topics. So at the moment, I'm loving the health and wellness, and it's just been really interesting. And I recorded my first solo podcast recently.
I'm going to say that to you, yeah.
Yeah, that was like I've heard people doing that, and I kind of thought, I might do that. And I thought, ah, no, sure, look, you've enough people now to be chatting to. And yeah. Then on 2/2/22 on the Tuesday, yeah. That special day, I remember seeing obviously that everyone was going on with the 2/2/2 thing, and I read up on it and it was saying how like you should manifest things and you should like set goals and you should like do these things on this day, and it's a really good day to do stuff. I was sitting on the couch and I was kind of going, I had all my admin done pretty early in the morning. I was like, right, I was like, what should I do for the rest of the day? The weather was miserable. I wasn't going to step outside. And I was kind of going, oh, what'll I do? And then I kind of got here and I was in my apartment and I said, it was like the solo podcast just kept coming up. And I was like, oh no, you're not doing that for a few more weeks. Forget about it. And it was just like this voice in my head was like, will you just get in there and record it and stop? So then I said, right, I'm just going to follow my gut. And like my gut was saying to do it. So I got into my bed. I put on the heater. I filled the hot water bottle. Put the duvet over.
Or the house coat.
Yeah, the house coat was on. It was. The house coat was on. And I stacked up my laptop and my microphone up on the pillows. And I just plugged everything in, pressed record. And so far has been my longest podcast to date.
Really? It's amazing because I had said the same thing for ages. So at Christmas time, I did that. So, well, I had someone interview me, but I was the guest, if you know what I mean. And I actually found it quite therapeutic, you know, just to kind of, just to not have to think about things that just rattle off whatever, you know, on your mind or whatever. And I actually find it quite therapeutic. I'm sure you did as well. Right, we're nearly there because we've got through quite a lot. I have a few other things, but we won't go through them all. We better give the guys a book club publishing a shout because obviously Chris is always raving about them. I had Dara on the last podcast and we gave them a plug there. So we'll give them another plug now as well.
Yeah, no, they've been great and they've been so supportive, and the whole team have just been brilliant. And I first came to them with my idea. My mum was publishing books about local history with Susan and Niall and all the book club. And then I just kind of said one day, I was like, I came to one of the meetings and I was like, hey, so I kind of have this idea for a book that I've had since probably a few days after Marcus died, because I knew, felt like someone needed to write a book about grief from a young person's point of view and from someone who's, I've just found I want to write something in really plain English that just made that I could read as well, if that made sense. Because at the time I couldn't find anything that I could read and that made sense to me. And I said, I'm going to do it. And I knew that through my 20s, I realized my early 20s, when I was going through my worst patch, I knew that I wasn't ready to write a book yet. I had to wait till I'd start to come through the other side to really, I guess, be able to give the whole view. And straight away they're like, yeah, we love it. We absolutely love it. And I just got a new job down in Limerick and I was moving down to start this new radio job, and I thought, can I just have a bit of time to get into this new role and the new city? Well, not, I guess it was a new city, but in some ways it was like a start over, because I moved into the city centre, whereas I would have lived out in UL for the 4 years, and the direction I'm pointing is UL. And that then after about a couple of months started putting pen to paper again, and the first book came out. And then there, New Year's Day last year, my second book came out, Little Pocket of Love. And as you mentioned, the Mental Health for Millennials Volume 6 is coming out, and it's just been a great opportunity. And you know what, the great thing about Book Hub is the community we now have. Like, that's how I got to know Chris and Dara. Like, I actually haven't met Dara in real life yet, but I feel like I've already known him because I've seen him already on social media. So that's what it's kind of become. It's become this community of people. And I met Dr. Phil through it, and Phil has been on my podcast, and then Phil actually in turn has had me in NUIG giving talks to students. So we all kind of work together. Yeah. And we, you know, we've just kind of, as I said, we've have this community now of people. So it's kind of, it's, guess it's more than just a publishing house. It's, as I said, it's a group of friends getting together, and it's just, you know, it's nice as well on social media, because anytime you go on Twitter, someone's going to be online that you can talk to. So it's lovely. It's actually just, it's really good. And as I said, they're really helpful as well.
Yeah, I probably spent too much time on Twitter, to be honest. It's probably not healthy. Right, we're nearly there. So I want to ask you quickly, what do you do now for to keep your mind clear? So I think I read, and obviously you can answer this yourself. So you do a bit of yoga, don't you? And you have your tag rugby and you have your writing. Is there anything else?
The meditation is definitely, I'd say, the biggest one for me. And I actually found that there's some days that I'm here and I'm like, oh, my head is just going 90, or I'm just having a bit of a block, or else I'm just not motivated at all. And then what I do is I go into my room, I lay out my yoga mat, I light some incense, and I just I'm like, right, that's it. Get down and you're going to meditate now for, and I find I prefer lying down for meditation. I don't know. I think when I'm sitting up, I just find that lying down suits me better. And I do a guided meditation, and suddenly I get up and it's like I feel completely different, or else I realize what the blockage is, or I can see clearer, or else I get really inspired. And I have all these different kind of things that go on. So I find the meditation is such a powerful tool, and I actually really enjoy it now. So that's definitely something huge for me. Tag rugby, yeah, is great for fitness, and then just socializing. Because as I said, some days I work from home, so there might be like I mightn't see my housemates because they're at work, and then I mightn't get a chance to leave the apartment or anything like that. And then, you know, I could be there going, oh my God, I haven't seen any human in real life today. And then tag rugby has that kind of socialization as well. And it's getting out and it's getting fit and active, and I love it. And it's competitive too, because it's definitely a streak I developed for my father. So I've got that going on. And yeah, I said that the writing is definitely a huge thing. And I enjoy going running, and I also took up Gaelic football last year. I think I played GA when I was a teenager in Ardrahan. And then I kind of was like, you know what? I wouldn't mind making more friends and like something fitness. So I was like, yeah. So I joined a Gaelic football team. So, you know, that's going on too. So I definitely like to keep myself busy, but I do find as well, the downtime, as we mentioned, is just as important. And when people say to me, oh my God, you're constantly going, I'm like, yeah, but I schedule my week. And if I know that, let's say Thursday is going to be a really busy day, I will either have a kind of chilled Wednesday or chilled Friday either side of it, so that I know. Brilliant. You know, yeah. And I think that's hugely important. I think it's so important to take your downtime and time alone as well, and just time it yourself.
I couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely 100%. That's something I never used to do, and I'm so glad that you've brought it up again, because like I said, it's so important, especially to me. I kind of had a bit of a burnout at Christmas time, and I said, right, that's it, I'm done. And I took a few weeks off. And I'm back now doing this, and I felt so much better. Where in the past, I would have just kept going and going and going. And as you know yourself, you're like a bubbling volcano. You're going to erupt, you know, but to anyone else. So it's, I couldn't agree with you more. Right, look, we've been here ages. And I didn't want to keep you so long. So thank you so much for giving up your time.
Sorry.
We might make this into a 6-part episode. One part every week. Do you have anything that you want to add or mention or plug or whatever before we go?
I suppose if anyone wants to reach out and talk, or, you know, I'm on social media. It's MEGHANNSCULLY. I'm on Twitter and I'm on Instagram. They're kind of my main ones. So if anyone ever wants to kind of, I guess, get in touch with me, you're more than welcome. And you can follow the journey there, and just kind of hope that I can give people a bit of hope and kind of show people that no matter how tough and how dark kind of the days can get, that they're, even though you can't see the light right now, it will be, you'll see it when you're ready.
Yeah. Look, you're a perfect example of that. As you said, you went from rock bottom, or, you know, in the darkness, and look where you are now. And look, I suppose it's ongoing, and you always have to look after things, but as you know yourself, like, I mean, you've gone in the right direction, and you're in a much better place now. So, I mean, like, well done, a fair play to you. Actually, before we go, I will stick the link to your book in the description of this, because if people want to get your book, it's on Book Club Publishing's website, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, perfect. Right, let's get out of here. It's probably still lashing rain, so you can go on, put your dressing gown on or your house coat on and go on.
No, thanks so much, Keith, for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, look, thanks very much for giving up your time. I know it's not easy to talk about certain things, but like I said, you are, I think, you're an inspiration, and I think what you've gone through and how you were looking after people and all that, it's just incredible. So, like, well done, fair play, and I just think that's amazing.
Thank you.
And look, we leave it there, right? thanks very much, Megan, again, for coming on the show. I really appreciate that. And I'll be back very soon with another episode of the Endless Spiral Podcast. Bye for now.